Today is June 14, 1979. My name is Sandra Schott, and I am interviewing Madeline Buble for the Castroville Public Library's Oral History Collection. Madeline was one of the telephone operators here in Castroville during 1948 and 1950, and we will be discussing that segment of her life. Okay, Madeline, first, when were you born?
I was born April 15, 1923.
And where?
In San Antonio.
In San Antonio. And who were your parents?
My father is Oscar Stubing, and my mother was Lenora Hayden.
Okay. And brothers and sisters?
I have one sister, Lorraine.
Lorraine. Okay. And who were your grandparents?
My daddy's parents' names were Sylvester Stubing and Shalastika Salas. And Grandma Stubing, Shalastika, came from Germany when she was 21 years old.
Oh.
From the little village, or dorp as they're called, was named Mickelgrumbach. It was near Frankfurt.
And that was your?
My paternal grandmother.
Oh.
And
so you already did some searching on that part, huh?
Yeah. Well, I asked a few questions from the older people within the family, and my grandmother, grandfather Haby was Emil Haby, and he was the son of Captain George Haby, who was came from Alsace, and he was in the Spanish-American War, therefore the title Captain.
Oh, I see.
George. And my grandmother was Lily Lehman, and her father and mother, her father's name was Joe. And he was sheriff here in Castroville at one time.
Joe Lehman?
Joe Lehman.
Well, who was Ed Lehman? Was that a brother?
Ed Lehman was my grandmother's brother.
Oh.
Her name was Lily. She was one of the older girls in the family. I believe the second oldest. There were 11 children, but she was the second.
11 Lehmans,
uh-huh,
though, would be.
Yeah.
Well, that's why that name comes up all the time. There
yes.
were a lot of them.
Yes, right. There were 11 children.
And they lived where?
They lived where Woodrow Sharp's ranch is now. That was their home.
With all of the children
all
there?
All the children, yes. And I have a picture of them lined up on the porch, all 11 kids, you know, standing over there on that porch. And it was quite an amusing situation because I have a picture of my grandfather Lehman, and he evidently was a real dresser and really, you know, very proud the way he looks. He's riding his horse. I have his picture. Anyway, he left my grandmother after she had the great grandmother after she had these 11 kids, and they divorced in 1891. And
divorce in 1891 was like a tragic thing,
especially with 11 kids.
Yeah,
I have the original divorce paper at home. It's written in longhand, brown ink on this this buff colored paper, regular lines, and it's all done in longhand, and it spells out exactly, well, let's see, I think he took all the cash they had, and she got the property and 11 kids.
Oh, wonderful. Gee, thanks. Well, what did he leave? He couldn't take all those 11 kids.
he had met some woman in San Antonio, and I think he remarried.
Remarried afterwards. Did she ever remarry?
She remarried and had another child. She had 12 eventually. I mean, total.
Uh-huh. Did she live to be very old?
86, I think. I remember her well. Well, I guess I was about 9 years old when she died, but I remember coming down here to visit her across from St. Louis School. There's a vacant lot now, but there used to be an old lumber house on that lot.
The back side. Mm-hmm. The back side of the school.
Yeah, I think St. Louis School bought.
And she lived there?
She lived on that corner. I'm trying to remember what happened to that house. It seems to me that they moved it somewhere, but I don't recall now what they did with it. But that's where she lived after she moved from this house out on the ranch.
And she lived alone while she was 86 till she died.
Well, I remember her second husband too.
She remarried.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you said she did.
He was Pete Grove, I believe was his name. I know it was Grope. I think the first name was Pete. And I remember him, too. But he died first.
Uh-huh. And then before she did.
Before she did, yeah.
And never, she got along just fine living by herself?
Yeah, until towards, I think, about the last 2 years or so.
She had plenty of kids, huh, to help her.
She was in San Antonio with some of the daughters in there. She had three daughters, I believe, lived in San Antonio.
And what, she sold that place then? That none of the kids, 11 kids, and not one of them kept the place?
Well, Ed, she sold it to Ed.
Oh, I see. Ed was one of her children.
Yeah, right. He was one of the sons, and she sold it to him. And I guess bought this house in Castroville. I could research back and find out, but I've got the whole abstract to that Lehman property at home. Faustina Sharp has it, you know, and she let me read it. And it was so fascinating that I asked Bill Burgess if he'd copy it for me on his copy machine. And he did, and he wouldn't. All he charged me was for the paper, and there was a lot of it in there that he was interested in, too.
And she had the abstract because of her husband buying the place.
Yeah, huh? Well, some of it was hers, too. If you read, oh, you mean Faustina?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. They had the abstract because they bought the
place.
Ed Lehman, I think, sold it to Mr. Charlie C. Sr.
Yeah, I believe they made a deal or something, Mr. Sharp and him.
And then he sold it to Woodrow, Mr. C.
And is that house up there the original house?
Yeah.
That's
the original house. It sure is.
That's the original house.
Now, I seem to remember going there, but, you know, I'm not positive.
About it.
Yeah. But it seems like I did.
She was this was your great-grandma then, right?
Right. My grandmother's mother. Yeah.
Oh. Gee, she must have lived to... Usually people didn't live that long back then, did they?
No, it was an extraordinary birth.
Especially having, 12 total kids then.
Yeah, yeah, she had 11 Lehmans and one Grove.
And there's no Lehmans around here right now?
At La Coste.
Oh, there is?
There is a Joe Lehman at La Coste. You remember the Pat Lehman who got... who was killed in the tractor here on the railroad track about... last summer?
No, I didn't hear.
You didn't hear about that? He was 48 years old, and he's a descendant, you know, it's funny that, you know, my great-grandparents had all these children, and most of their children, I guess my grandmother had the most. She had 6 children, but 3 of them died, and from 2 of them before they were a year old, and 1 when it was 2 years old. And my mother was the oldest child, and then the other 3 died, and then the 2 brothers lived, Clarence and Gabe. Well, Gabe is the oldest, Gabe, and then Clarence. And she had 6, but all of the other...
And Gabe Habe is her brother then, huh?
He was my mother's brother, yeah. Oh. My uncle. But of all these 11 or 12 children, some of them didn't have any children, and most of them just had 1. Or 2.
And came in that big family.
Big family, yeah. It was really funny. I mean, it just went zilch, you know,
to
not many descendants, because most of them just had 1 child or 2 children.
2 children. Mm-hmm. Well, you were, how is it that you were at Rio Medina, or that you got above Rio Medina there, that you were raised up there?
Well,
if you said you were born in San Antonio, was that just because of the hospital that you were born there?
No? Well, no. See, my dad's parents bought this 800-acre tract of land, and that's where we lived. And when his parents got too old to stay out on the farm, they divided the 800 acres between the 4 sons. They had 6 children, 2 daughters and 4 sons. And they gave the land to the 4 sons and cash to the 2 girls. And that's up... the property fronts on 471, Farm Road 471, and Tally Road. And the Geronimo Village is part of the original tract of land.
That is all sold now? Is that in anybody's?
The Geronimo Village, of course, that was my Uncle Ludwig's piece of property, and he sold that to the Anderson Corporation, and they made this trailer park out of it. And our property is next to it. And see, that's up in the northwest, kind of the northwest corner of Bexar County. Mm-hmm. Okay, my grandfather, Emil, and his wife, Lily, and grandpa's brother, George, who was a bachelor.
And these were all Habies.
These were Habies, yeah. They had this piece of property right across the road from my, really their property joined my grandpa Stubing's property. And my grandpa and Uncle George were in partnership. They farmed together and ran cattle together and everything. They each had their individual tract of land, but they were side by side, and that property joined my grandpa Stubby. That's how my mother and my dad met. They were neighbors.
Oh, that was my next question.
Yeah, they were neighbors. See.
Oh.
They lived right across the creek from one another, across the San Geronimo.
Well, now, didn't you say your mother's mother was a layman?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did they get over there then?
Well, she married... I really don't know how they bought that property up there. I have not found that out.
Yet.
I'm going to have to find out because I'm curious myself.
Too, huh?
And they have a Alsatian style house on it. Now, that's another thing I'm curious about. I'd like to know if my grandfather and his brother built that house or if the house was there
when they bought
the property. Because his brother. Yeah, it was his brother, Joe Habey, bought the property right next to him. So evidently these boys, see, they were George Habey's sons, the three of them, George and Joe and Emil, they had property side by side up there. I suppose when they became adults that they went and bought it, I guess.
Maybe. So they could have more since there was three of them.
Yes, and then Grandpa Habey had a sister, Christina. She was retarded. She never progressed beyond about a four-year-old mentally,
oh,
you know.
Awesome.
And the old folks in their will said that whoever would keep her after their death, why, they would give that child her
whoever
portion
it would be.
Of the property. So my grandfather and grandmother Habey took her.
Uh-huh.
Her name was Christine, and that therefore they got a nice strip of land at Remedina that belonged to Grandpa Captain Great Grandfather George.
Gosh.
See, he had that piece of property right below that. You know, when you cross the Remedina Bridge and you come up around that sharp U-turn,
right,
to go up, and right below the hill on the right side is where Buddy Bentley has his cow pen,
yes,
and his little slaughterhouse. Well, there's two old rock buildings there.
Yeah.
All right. The one that's parallel to the highway was their home, George Habey's home.
Oh.
And the one that runs the other direction, he had a saloon and a store in there.
Right there.
And then there's a little log cabin that's still there, and that was a school. It's very small, but they had their first public
school.
Well, was
that Rio Medina right there then instead of where it is right now? Or did they call that some kind of a little...
I think that actually was Rio Medina, you know,
at one time.
Because the house that Ralph Beck lives in and owns was a Catholic church. At one half, they had church services
in there. Mm-hmm. So that may have been the first little...
Yeah, see, the Habies and the Beck, all came from Elsass. They came, most of them, from Oberensen. And the Becks were mostly girls, and the Habies were mostly boys.
So it worked out real well.
Right. They married, you know, they married.
Uh-huh.
The Habies usually married that girl. But they didn't stay here in Castroville. They moved out up there to...
They had come from Castroville and moved up to that area.
With Castro.
Uh-huh.
Nicholas Habey came with Castro on one of the first trips. He was the brother of George. He would have been my great-great-uncle. And his house was right on top of the hill where A.O. Beck lives. A.O. Beck lives in the Nicholas Habey house.
Uh-huh.
And then he went back to Europe and got the rest of the family. After he came with the first group, I believe I'm right about that.
Uh-huh.
And then after he was here a year or so, he went back and got all his brothers and sisters, and his father was still living. His name was, I believe, Franz Joseph. I found his gravestone up on the graveyard here. last time I was up there.
Is there a graveyard at Rio Medina anywhere? No?
There used to be, but it used to be on my grandfather's property. He bought, he inherited that strip of land, part of it from his father outright, and then part of it for keeping the sister.
Oh.
But then he bought the piece of property across the highway from it. Mm-hmm. It goes down to the river, and he had one pecan bottom down there, and he bought a second one. And that has a big old Alsatian house on it, and that property belonged to Otto Habe, who was Irma Bediger's daddy. And
there was a cemetery on that?
There was a cemetery on that piece of property. I remember when I was a kid, we'd go...
Did it have markers?
It had markers and everything. It was had a fence around it. And, I guess there was 10 or 15 graves, something like that in it. Probably all Habe's, you know.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And sometime after my grandparents moved there, they moved in the early 30s, about 1931, I think, is when they moved from the place up on the San Geronimo, mm-hmm. up close to what used to be called Cliff, Texas. There was even a post office there at one time. And they moved down to Rio Medina, and then after they were there a few years, all those graves were moved, and they're here at Castroville now.
Oh, I was just going to say, where are they, if they're still there or not? They're all here?
They're all here at Castroville. They had them all moved.
Well, you know, you were saying that the Becks and the Habes were here at Castroville. Was there anything at Rio Medina before they went that direction? Nothing.
They just went up there, and I don't know how they got their property. There again, you'd have to go back in the abstracts to find out. I don't know if it was a land grant.
And what year, yeah.
Or if they bought it.
Or why they went that, why didn't they go south or mm-hmm. west or, you know, why they went north.
Now, I understand.
But still along the river.
Yes.
That might have been something.
All of them. All the way up that a road to the Medina Lake, wherever you see these old Alsatian style houses, and they're all along the road.
Yeah,
you
can see them everywhere.
Go down by Stein's and come back through that.
Oh yeah,
through
that
there,
dirt road.
Uh-huh. That dirt road, and then go on up. All of those, that was all Habe's. All of those houses.
Hmm.
And our Becks, but mostly Habe's.
Habe's and Becks.
And because of the
well, and were they all Catholic, the Habes?
Oh, yeah.
And the Becks were?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the Turpies were Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
And they were from up that away too. And that's before the Civil War time, so I don't know. When in this church you were talking about, that was a Catholic church,
yeah.
Not a Lutheran
mm-hmm.
church.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Right. Now, I don't know which one of the Habes. There's a house right across from Ralph Beck's house, and that belonged to Frank Habe. Now, he was Grandpa's first cousin. That's Daly Holthouse's parents.
Oh.
And that's a beautiful old house, and it's just going to pop. It's just falling down, and it's such a pretty old two-story.
Is that one on the road?
Yeah, it's all in brush, you know, getting overgrown with brush. Ralph Beck's is on the right when you go down.
Is this when you go straight through Rio Medina, or did you turn left and go up the river?
You could take that gravel road. You know, instead of making the...
Yes. You go up that turn, but you go to the dirt road instead of staying on the pavement.
Yeah, right. And then further down a little bit, well, Clarence Wurzbach's house was one of those Habe houses. And then James Habe. It's his brother. I can't think of his first name now. He still lives in his.
Mm-hmm.
But...
You were talking there where Bindley has all that, was a little store and what happened. Now, was that owned by your
great-grandpa,
yeah?
George?
And he run the store and
mm-hmm,
everything?
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine getting supplies over there to that store?
I don't know
how they did that.
I wish there was somebody that I could talk to that we would remember something
about it.
But
in a saloon like that?
I haven't been able to find anybody that...
Even
yeah.
can talk about
mm-hmm.
it. Well, we really got off of the subject.
Yeah, telephone company.
That was interesting, though. And you have one child, don't you?
Yes.
And that is Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have now two grandchildren,
Jennifer and Kirk, and
one on the way.
By July, huh? Yes.
All right. Well, let's get on then too. We wanted some little background. Now we got a lot of background, so we'll go ahead with
you got a lot of background on my ancestors.
Well, I was curious about the layman. I know a lot of people talked about them, but I never could put them all together. So someday we'll have it all together here. All right. When did you, or why did you become a telephone operator? I mean, what was the deal? You graduated, and was this your first job after you graduated, or?
Well, I was married already, and
had
Tommy. He was about 4 years old, I guess, when I started working. Oh. No, we lived on a farm, my father's farm at first, and then my husband got sick. He had a kidney removed, and he was sick and couldn't really work for a while.
And he was farming up there then.
We moved down here, and I worked at Remedina at the store for about 3 months right after Mr. Reem passed away. You know, Vivian's daddy.
Oh, yeah, he
had. Vivian Beck's daddy had the store, and he had died, and I worked for her about 3 months, but I had applied for the telephone, a job at the telephone company. I just needed a job.
That did sound like a good.
Yes. And there was an opening, so I got it. We worked,
Well, who did the hiring?
Mr. Ed Seacats, he was the manager. He lived up at Medina Lake, but he was the manager of the company, and he did the hiring.
Mm-hmm. I see. And what was the name of that company you were saying? It was
the Medina San Geronimo Telephone Company. Mm-hmm. And it was a shareholder type of thing. When it was originally started, they went around and sold shares to a lot of the local people to get enough money together so they could install the equipment, you know.
Oh.
And anyway, I got the job. I started on 1st of July, I believe, or the 15th of July, I don't remember exactly, in 1948. 1st of July, I believe. And we worked, there were two operators during the day. One worked from 7 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon, and the other one from 1 to 7 in the evening. And then every other Sunday, you worked 7 to 7, so you've got one day off in 2 weeks. And I took the afternoon shift because I had the child, you know. I felt like it was better for me to work in the afternoon. That way, he wasn't in school yet when I started, but when he went to school a year or so afterwards, and that way I could be there to get him off to school and everything, and then he caught a ride.
And you lived here in Castro?
No, we lived with Fred's parents at first, on the farm, right out of town. And so now that it was on the L.W. Burrell Ranch, but that's where we lived for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. While you were working
while
at the telephone.
While I was working at the telephone company. And
well, who else was it that worked with you at the shift?
Winnell Gent, Craig now, was the morning operator, and Madeline Tundry, Mrs. Otto Tundry, worked the night shift from 7 at night till 7 in the morning. Because after 10:30 or 11, maybe some nights there wouldn't be but one or two calls, you know, and they had a loud bell and they'd just go to bed and sleep, you know, and the bell would wake them up whenever somebody
that sounded like a good shift to have,
yeah.
too.
But that was every night. She had no relief.
She never Sundays, Saturdays, and
every
everything.
Night. She never had a day off. No vacations. And because she worked the 12-hour shift, she got $120 a month. And the two of us that worked the day shift, we had to split that $120, so we each got $60 a month.
Can you imagine? And who wrote out your checks and fixed all that? Who did all the paperwork?
Mr. Seacats, and he never was on time, and we were all
needed the money.
We couldn't hardly make it from one paycheck to the next, you know.
And you got paid once a month
once
then?
Once a month.
Oh, my
gosh.
We
were supposed to get paid on the first.
And all in one lump sum, that big check.
Yeah, that big check. And I wanted to go on strike for $5 more.
Just for $5 more, that's all you wanted.
Right.
Let's see, tell me some different little things. How did y'all work that?
Well, you had the old heavy headset. when I first started. You've seen them in the movies. The yes, old movies, yes. You know, with the big ear phone and the heavy, they'd have a strap around your neck with this
speaker on it
on
then.
It, you know? And then after we were, after I was there about a year, they bought some of these new little modern ones, you know, that had the little tiny earpiece with the little stem and the little round mouthpiece.
Oh.
And man, we thought we were uptown when we
really graduating there.
Yeah, I think, well, there was only one operator at a time, and the board, I had about 300, I guess, I'm guessing, I don't really remember,
mm-hmm.
about 200 drops, I guess. And you had the double plug, you know, you picked up one side and plugged into the ringing number, and you said, what did we say? Operator? I believe that's what we said. And then you, when they gave you what they wanted, then you picked up the other half of the dual plugs, you uh-huh. know, and plugged into whatever number they wanted. And then
so
rang.
If somebody wanted you to, like if I wanted to call somebody, I would dial what?
You didn't dial.
You didn't dial anything.
Your telephone, the old style telephones had a crank. You lifted your receiver
uh-huh.
and gave crank. One crank, and that would
ring the
in,
operator.
Ring in on my switchboard.
Oh, so you would hear a ring where you were.
Yeah, see, it was the number would flop down. It would buzz and flop down.
I was going to say, how did you know which was ringing? Yeah.
The ringing number would flop down. It would buzz in little fields. It was supposed to flop down, let me put it that way. They
didn't always do that.
And then you had to look around on the board trying to figure out where it was coming from, you know. But
and then you would, okay, I would say, hello, Madeline, and then you would say what?
I'd say, number please, you know, or operator.
Okay.
And then you'd say, well, I want number 5-6, or, you know, I believe that was Blackie Cheerheart's number. I'm pretty sure 5-6. I know it was.
Uh-huh.
And
you would just connect them.
Then I connected the other plug to his number, and then you had a little button on your table portion of the board,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have to ring the corresponding lever, pull that little lever to match up with the two plugs. See, you had all these little buttons down at the bottom.
And did they have numbers on them?
No, you didn't need a number there. Each one corresponded with the two plugs, you know, set
that
of
went
plugs
together.
That went together. See, like you had two plugs, and then you had the little button right uh-huh. lined up. And
oh,
you picked
I see.
Up
all
one
of them.
To plug into the ringing number, and then you picked up the corresponding one to plug into the number that the party wanted. And after you had those two plugs lined up, then you
turned the switch, and they could talk.
You pulled a little switch, and when the other person answered the telephone,
uh-huh.
well, then they could talk.
But only till you turned the little switch, huh?
You'd have to open it to hear if they were through. Or,
I was going
to
say, how did you know when to close it off?
Well, there was your board was supposed to show you. You know, it was supposed to have a little colored thing that flopped up and showed you when it was a disconnect. But your board was so old and rickety that you never could trust it.
Trust it.
And you had to constantly go in on the line to see if they were through talking,
or
not. And you had the party lines out in the country were really wild. They were, you know, they were scattered out so far over such a big territory. It went up.
And you answered those too?
Oh,
then?
Yes. Uh-huh. It went all the way to Medina Lake, and it went all around in the Rio Medina area. And out towards the Divine area, there was a line out that way, and there was one that went all the way up to the Shoeharts on the Farm Road 471. And
how about Quihee Way too?
Yeah.
And Dunley?
Out
to go
Dunley.
To Dunley,
yeah,
too?
Out.
But not to Hondo.
Mm-mm. It stopped out at Dunley somewhere. I don't know where to go.
And it didn't go as far as San Antonio either.
No.
No.
But all of those country roads had these telephone wires. Well, depending upon which road it went up and how many people lived on the road, that's how many people would be connected to that one line. I know the Bames, you know, all the Bames on the Rio Medina Road, George uh-huh. Bame and Bill and Herbert Wurzbach and the Wingenropes and the Hutzlers and the Haglunds and the Berquins, and you, I guess there was 20
people
on one line. And every telephone rang when you rang
the operator.
One party, or if they'd ring the operator or you'd ring one of those numbers, everybody's phone rang. So you had to have 20, say you had 20 parties on one line, which was, I think, the most we had, but we did have the one line that was that heavy. You had to have a different ring for each party, like you'd have a long short or a short long or two short or three short.
Short or something.
Or three long or long short long. Or
you should have just let everybody lift it up and say, okay, we want so and so.
And so that's the... And I think...
And you could make it ring so many times from where you were?
Yeah, you could keep, you know, you could...
And you ring. Had track of who yeah, you, ring was so many times.
Right,
and,
right.
And was there a telephone book?
Yes.
There was a telephone
book.
What's those
numbers? And we have, and the way they do it, they put the person's name, and then they put LSL, like long, short, long. That was the ring.
Instead of number 1, 2, 3 or something.
And it would be line 5, you know, or line 6.
Oh,
six,
I see.
Or line
for
8.
The party line ones,
yeah,
out in the country.
Party line and LSL or SS, too short, uh-huh. Or, you know.
And when somebody wanted a telephone, what did they do to, you know, like now you got to put down a $50 deposit and you call out to the business office or what have you. How did somebody who wanted a phone back then, what did they have to do to get a phone?
They would just call in and
tell the operator.
Tell us that they wanted one, and we'd get a hold of Mr. Seacats, and Mr. Rudolph Bippert from Lacoste was the repairman at that time, and then he'd install them. Now, this again, I'm not sure about. It's been so long ago. But it seems to me like it was $15. Now I'm guessing, I'm not positive.
To get a phone.
I think that's what it
is. And they would come out and set the box up and run your line to your house give you a number there.
Yeah, right. And
a monthly rate, how did they pay that?
I believe it was $2.
And where did they pay?
They usually came to the telephone office and paid.
And the operators would collect there?
We'd collect. Some of it would mail it, you know, but some of them would bring it in, and then we had our telephone in the telephone office, you know. People would come and make local calls, and some of them would come and make long-distance calls. And then we had to collect, we had to time them, and we had a rate
to charge
for each city. And
well, now you say long-distance. How did you call long-distance?
We had two long-distance lines. We had two to San Antonio, I believe, and one that went directly to Lacoste. I think the toll charge to Lacoste was a dime.
Mm-hmm.
It was toll at that time.
Oh,
long
toll
distance.
Call.
Mm-hmm.
They call it
toll
calls. Toll
calls. Mm-hmm. It was long. That means long distance.
Some people still say that. They call a long distance a toll call.
Yeah. Well, that's what.
That's where they got that word
right.
from.
And the telephone operators have their own lingo, you know, when they talk back and forth.
Well, would you have to connect with an operator then in San Antonio?
Yes. I'd get the information from my party, and we had a little yellow ticket. And it was, the top portion said from, you know, the calling party, and two, if it was person to person or just a station number, just the number, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But everything went through San Antonio. And they timed it also, see, and then they'd give us the charges afterwards.
And that's what you would charge.
That's what we charged then. We put that on our ticket because, see, they, and there were very few calls that we timed ourselves, you know.
And then what, did you have to send that money to San Antonio?
Yeah, then San Antonio would get part of it.
So y'all would kind of like split
mm-hmm.
it. And Lacoste, did they have a telephone operator over there?
Rudolph Bippert, I told you earlier, installed all of our telephones.
Uh-huh,
well, he and his wife owned the telephone company
at Lacoste.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a whole different name for that.
I guess it was just the Lacoste Telephone Company, I believe.
And they each had their own.
Yeah, each had their own company, but they owned it and operated it.
Uh-huh.
Or an income, you know,
that was their livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
Can you beat that?
And, I get, well, some of the people, it's amusing, it's really funny what they expect. it was a very personal thing you had with your contact with the people, you know. And they knew by your voice who was on duty.
Uh-huh.
And they knew you were right at the hub of things, center right. of everything. And they, like Mrs. Blackie Cheerheart, Mrs. Ralph Cheerheart, they were in business at the time. I think he still had the Lone Star business.
Uh-huh.
And naturally, she needed to get a hold of him. And he was famous for not
being
in
there.
One spot and one, you know, longer
Very
than
long.
5 minutes. And she'd say, "Madam, have you seen Blackie?" And I'd say, "Well, wait, I'll go look and see if he's down the street somewhere or something." You know, this type of thing. If Faustine was in the shop, was another one that was, "Has Woodrow called in from anywhere? I need to get a hold of him." "Oh, yeah, he was here so-and-so a few minutes ago. I'll see if I can find him," you know, this type of thing. And
well, that's true. You would know what was going mm-hmm. on, where, when, and how, so that was the best source to...
You learned to know their voices, too. You know, you knew who you were talking to by the voice.
Uh-huh.
You got so accustomed to it.
To hearing a voice mm-hmm. instead of a...
And they... Connie Reen, she would call, and she'd say, "Call my mother for me."
Oh, you know? Okay. Oh, all right. I know your mother's number right here.
Yeah, you learned to... Well, you knew them all. You memorized them. And Woodrow Sharp was... He and Mr. Merle were absolutely the two worst people as far as long distance was concerned I have ever dealt with in my...
Those two had a lot of long distance phone calls.
Many, yes. Mr. Merle was... he was in... Well, he was in business for himself, and he was trying to
What
buy,
kind of a business was he in?
Well, he was trying to buy some kind of turbines, whatever that is,
uh-huh.
in Mexico, from Mexico, and have them transported here to the United States, and what he was going to do with them then, I don't have the slightest idea.
But he was calling Mexico.
But he was calling Mexico. Had you ever
That's
tried to
out
call
of the
Mexico?
Country. That's out of the country.
Oh, I'd work sometimes for hours on one call from him, you know, keep trying.
Uh-huh. And he would and wait for you?
Just no. as soon as I'd have the party, then he'd be gone. And that's what Woodrow would do. He'd say, get me the Rio Vista Ranch.
Uh-huh.
Bang, he'd hang up.
Uh-huh.
That's just the way he did. He didn't even give me a chance to answer him or anything.
Right.
Just give me the Rio Vista Ranch, bang. Okay. I'd get them. Sometimes you couldn't get through right away, but
uh-huh.
I'd get them and I'd call back. "I have the so-and-so on the line for Dr. Sharp." "Well, he's not here. He just left."
And to find him is nowhere.
Right. And I think the most unusual experience, I guess, I had during the 2 years, 2.5 years I worked there, 2 years and 3 months, in January of 1949, we had a terrific snowstorm. It was about 8 or 9 inches deep.
My gosh.
And it happened on a Saturday night. Uh-huh. And the next morning was my Sunday. I was supposed to work that Sunday. Well, I couldn't get the car started, and you know how that is.
Oh, in the winter,
and
yeah.
Like that, and had to drive in the snow, and so I didn't get to work on time. I called in and told Matt, and I said, "I'll be there as quick as I can. Can't get the car started, and it's ice and everything else, so..." I guess I got here about 8. I was supposed to be here at 7. And then she went on home. Well, the snow was gorgeous, and it was really deep. I can't remember
ever
seeing it that deep since, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I took a buku of pictures, and I even took pictures from the old telephone company out here of the city
hall
and the back, let's see, Robert Cheerheart's property where Francine Ehlinger lives, you know, that
uh-huh,
backyard,
uh-huh.
You could see that, and I took some. But that was absolutely the worst day I ever went through in my life at that telephone company. Everybody called everybody.
To see how the snow was.
Right. "Did you see the snow? Isn't it beautiful? Let's go so-and-so and walk in the snow. You know." The whole board, all day long, I couldn't keep up with it. I didn't have enough connections.
Oh,
so and then they'd get irritated with me because
you
I
couldn't make
answer,
them.
And uh-huh. I couldn't. I didn't have any connections left. And the rings were just coming in, you know. And when I'd get to them, I'd say, "I'm sorry, I didn't have a line to pick up." And uh-huh. some of them could, it's funny, people too, you know, they're not looking at you. They wouldn't say the things they say to you
face to face
as they will on a telephone.
It's a lot easier.
They'll call you out and good over a telephone where they wouldn't dream of doing it if they had to look at you, you know.
That's right.
And then everybody had to call somebody long distance too. Did it snow at your house? Two long distance lines and all of these people
wanting to call long distance.
It was absolutely
unreal. Well, how much did it cost them to call to San Antonio?
I mean, it was 30 cents.
Well, that's all. It's cheaper now.
It's cheaper now. It is. Uh-huh. It was more. I think 30 or 35 was the minimum for 3 minutes. 35 cents.
Well, was there paved roads then with this snow, or was it all dirt roads?
No, it was all paved.
It was still paved. It was paved already then.
Yeah, 1949.
Yeah, that would be paved already.
It was. It was paved, but it was okay. In 49, we had an old Chevrolet. I believe it was an old 29 Chevrolet, beat up thing. Well, naturally, you had to drain the water out of it the night before.
Because there was no antifreeze such thing.
Well, there might have been,
but nobody had any.
Couldn't afford to buy it anyway. And Tom got water in the car and got the old thing going, you know, and got down here. It just took...
That long to...
It took time.
Well, that was the big...
But that was a day I'll never forget.
That's why you got that date down pat.
I have... In fact, I have... I made a book for Tommy, which I'll give him one of these days. Uh-huh. From the day he was born, I have a picture when he was 3 days old, I think. And I kept a complete history of events and places and dates. And I wrote just like a narrative, you know.
Along with it.
And I wrote, and it's a big scrapbook size, you know. And I've got all of my snow pictures on one page. And the date and exactly what happened. I've got a whole page of narrative written just about the day.
Well, that might make a good subject, just something. Year 1949, when it snowed, where were you?
Yeah.
Or are you calling Madeline on the telephone?
It was something.
You know, it seems like in the back of my mind, when I was very small, it snowed real deep. And we lived behind my grandma's. And that was probably, I'd have been about 3 years old, and that'd be just about right.
You were...
That was 46. That was in 49. That would have been
43. Tommy was 6 years old.
He probably remembers it too.
Yeah, I have pictures of him. I think he had his grandpa's boots on or something, you know, to get out in the snow so he wouldn't get wet feet. And just a little old tyke, you know.
Earlier you had told me about when there was a fire or a flood or whatever. How did y'all do that with the telephone? There was a...
Well, anything that went on in the community, and especially a death, always a death or a fire, they would call it a signal, and it was the operator's duty to contact all the people in the rural area. Well, now the fire, we had the fire whistle button. And somebody would call in a fire.
Uh-huh.
I'll get back to the signal in a minute. I'm just having to think about this fire thing.
Uh-huh.
We had the button there on our switchboard, and the whistle was right above the telephone office and almost blew your head off, you know. And when someone would call in a fire, we'd have to find out where it was and then ring the fire alarm whistle. And then everybody in town would call in and say, "Where's the fire?"
Oh,
you know.
Oh gosh!
And so
that's how you found out where the fire was,
right,
and they could. And there was there a volunteer fire department?
Mm-hmm, there was a volunteer fire department.
Then,
which was pretty new, I would imagine, because the Legion Hall, of course, was built after World War II, and that was ended in 45. So the volunteer fire department must have just been in its infancy, I would imagine.
Right, just really.
Yeah.
Getting underway.
Mm-hmm. But that's how we told the firemen and anybody in town, you know,
where to go to help with the fire or whatever.
And then on deaths or something, anything else that the community needed to be notified about, they would tell us what the message was. And like if it was a death, you'd say who died and when the rosary was going to be in the mass and all of this. But you would give what they call the signal on your rural line, and you'd ring a whole bunch of little short rings, you know, like about 20 or 25 little short rings, little deep, deep, deep like that, you know. And then the people on the line.